really not clear when we look back on Merkel in 20 years' time whether she's going to go down as the woman who saved Europe or the woman who destroyed Europe. It seems to me that both of those things are possible.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm Cameron Abadi, FP's deputy editor for foreignpolicy.com. You're listening to the ER. I'm in Washington today, and I'm joined in studio by Constanze Stelzenmüller and Hans Kundnani. Constanze is the inaugural Robert Bosch Senior Fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at Brookings. She's an expert on German, European, and transatlantic foreign and security policy and strategy. Prior to working at Brookings, she was a Senior Transatlantic Fellow with the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Hans Kundnani is a Senior Transatlantic Fellow in the Europe Program at the German Marshall Fund. He works on internal European economic and institutional issues and Europe's role in the world. Hans previously served as research director at the European Council on Foreign Relations. ER nerds, we love hearing from you. Have episode ideas or comments? You can email us at any time at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. So we're here today to talk about the German election, which just happened yesterday. The campaign, which went on through the summer, was described as the most boring in the world in recent memory, which was a relief in some ways, about a year after Brexit and Donald Trump's election. You know, we even had a piece on our website discussing how boring it was and how Germans were talking more about Boris Becker midsummer than they were about Angela Merkel. And now the boring election happened, and now everyone's talking about so many exciting things. We're talking about neo-Nazis and the Bundestag. We're talking about coalition by the name of Jamaica out of some reason. We're talking about France's president cursing his fate. And so all sorts of exciting things happened at an election that everyone was describing as so boring. The ultimate result is that Angela Merkel is going to stay chancellor. That much is clear. But a lot of other things have happened. So let's talk about it. I guess let's start with Merkel herself. Hans, would you say that Merkel won this election? Did she lose this election? I feel like there's been a lot of commentary both ways. It's sort of been a little ambiguous. So what do we say? Did she win or not?
Well, she clearly lost the election in the sense that you know, this was the worst result for the Christian Democrats since the creation of the Federal Republic in 1949. I think Constanze is about second worst. Which was the worst?
31% in 1941.
Okay, there you go.
You hear that? Nerds, write that down.
Okay.
It's important. There'll be a quiz afterwards.
Not a great start. Yeah. But you know, the Christian Democrats are still the biggest party, and as you said, will form a government. So in that sense, you could say that she won. But I think the thing that was most surprising about the election yesterday was how badly the CDU did. Everything else was pretty much as expected. The AfD did a little bit better than they were expected to. I think the projections were somewhere between 8% and 12%, and they got 13%. The SPD did basically as badly as people were expecting. Was at the lower end of the projection, but it wasn't, again, a surprise. So the only thing that was really a surprise was that the CDU did worse than we were expecting.
Let's slow down here and actually break down some of those acronyms. When you said the AfD did about as well as expected, what is the AfD, and what should we think about that? Constanze, do you want to tell us what the AfD is?
Let me, if I may, just retread some of that ground and do the acronyms. So the CDU got its second worst showing historically since the creation of the Federal Republic. That's bad enough. Its Bavarian sister party, CSU, did get its worst showing ever, which is really bad for its leader, Horst Seehofer, who I think would have loved to have been part of an intra-party challenge against Merkel now. People who want to introduce a much more hard-edged conservative course against her modernizing moderateness. The Social Democrats also got their worst result since 1949. This is the SPD acronym, Social Democratic Party. So really, somewhat like in France, a dramatic result for the mainstream parties. And I don't really like using the term mainstream because that's already sort of adopting the language of the extreme factions. But let's just say the parties that have been occupying the political center of Germany ever since the recreation of Germany after World War II. So that's already pretty dramatic. Merkel's personal bad showing really means that she has, unlike during the summer when we thought she would have four coalition options, she now has only one. because the Social Democrats, our current coalition partners in a grand coalition, have already said, we're not doing this again. We want to go in opposition. And actually, they're doing the country a favor, because otherwise the alternative for Germany, the AfD, would be the largest opposition party, giving it special rights, such as the right to chair the budget committee, which I think nobody in their right minds can want.
And why is that? What is the problem with AfD exactly?
Well, the alternative for Germany is, I wouldn't call them neo-Nazis. It does contain neo-Nazis. And because it's now got 12.6% of the vote, it gets a party faction, as it's called, a Fraktion, of, I think at this point, 94 members, most of whom don't even have experience in local government, are very right-wing, and some of them are extremely right-wing. One of the things, one of the reasons why the alternative for Germany should concern us so much is that they did, indeed, for most of the summer, make a very poor showing publicly. I mean, they had had a party conference in the spring where it was vicious leadership infighting all the way, and people essentially thought they were spent political force. And throughout the summer, they were stuck at 7 to 8%. And then in the last 2-3 weeks before this Sunday election, they were suddenly on a roll. They captured social media. They have a huge Facebook presence. I think it's at about more than half a million, more than the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats together. They have a commanding presence on Twitter. And they also suddenly mounted a really ferocious street campaign. They sent howling and jeering protesters to every single appearance of the chancellor. And the chancellor, I think, made the mistake of not speaking to them. She just ignored them. She had to be protected. So all the images that you got from these street campaigns was of Merkel being heavily protected by bodyguards, going into these speeches, giving her speech, being jeered and whistled at, and being led out again by bodyguards.
So let's rewind this even a little bit more, because, you know, we all follow German politics here in the studio, and I'm sure everyone listening. But just to review, if someone fell asleep 5 years ago, I remember the AfD party, how it started. It was a sort of mild-mannered economist by the name of Beyond Lucke. He basically started this party with very sort of dry academic arguments about the European Union. And now, all of a sudden, if someone just woke up after a 5-year coma, and all of a sudden, you have the people running the party are praising the soldiers in the Second World War. They're talking about disposing of immigrants who are currently in the country, who are born there in Germany.
The one they wanted to dispose of is a German cabinet minister who has a German passport, but who has Turkish roots, and they wanted to deport her to Anatolia.
And so, again, this I think needs some explanation. How did a dry party that was arguing about the euro end up in such an extremist category? What happened to the AfD? Hans, do you have some thoughts on that?
Well, yes, it's a sort of long story. I mean, it's not completely surprising in the sense that lots of the Eurosceptic parties across Europe are also anti-immigrant. So that combination, I think, is not completely unusual or surprising. And I suppose the thing that links those two sets of issues is the principle of freedom of movement. But, you know, I suppose the short version of what happened to the AfD is that, as you say, they were created as this professor's party, basically an economic liberal party. That overlaps, I think, in many ways with the FDP's views on economic issues and on the Eurozone in particular. But there were these various different factions within the party. They seemed to be imploding, and then the refugee crisis came along and gave them a sort of second life, as it were, which they've exploited very successfully. I have to say, I think, though, that the mainstream parties, to use that term again, do bear a lot of responsibility for the rise of the AfD. And in particular, this grand coalition that we've had for the last 4 years has, I think, structurally enabled the rise of the AfD. But also, I think the AfD is actually a really interesting party in many ways. And in particular, I think one of the things that's very striking to me about it is the way that we've heard a lot in the last 24 hours about the way that this is a sort of male-dominated party in terms of the voters. I mean, I think that's been a little bit exaggerated because it's not as if women didn't vote for it. But apart from the question of gender, I think what's very, very striking about the AfD is that it actually integrates people from different classes, in other words, income groups in Germany, different ages. So I think it's a very strong argument to call the AfD what the Germans call a Volkspartei, which is a sort of integrative party, at a time when some of the other mainstream parties, like the SPD, are sort of moving away from that and becoming less of a Volkspartei. The AfD, I think, this is part of the reason why I think it's there to stay, is because it does actually cut across different strata in German society in a way that very few of the other parties do.
I want to burrow down a little bit more in terms of what you said in terms of holding the mainstream parties accountable. Yesterday after the election, one of my favorite things about German elections is that after the election, they have something on national television, I guess it's called the Elefantenrunde, which is, in contrast to the U.S. elections where you have to stay up and wait for a concession speech, an acceptance speech, et cetera, et cetera. In Germany, after the election, they get all the party leaders together on one set right after the election, and they all have to confront each other together with a couple of journalists.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
No, I love it. I think it's a much more, much preferable. Yeah. Rather than having to listen to boring speeches, you have to see the sort of looks on their faces just like right after the tallies come in, and they all have to kind of defend themselves. So in yesterday's Elefantenrunde, I guess the translation of that is round of elephants, something like that.
The party leaders, yep.
The elephants being the party leaders. So in that, I remarked upon how the SPD candidate, Martin Schulz, immediately turned on Merkel and held her responsible. She said the fact that the AfD is on this stage, the fact that the AfD has risen to 14%, 13.something%, is Mrs. Merkel's fault. Constance, what do you think about that diagnosis? Did Merkel allow the AfD to rise by not pushing traditional CDU policies in the migration crisis? Was that something that she ought to have had more in mind, the role that the CDU traditionally plays?
So a couple things here. First, the election outcome itself. I mean, it's notable that we use only paper ballots, yet you get fairly accurate polls at 6 p.m. on election day. And by midnight on election day, which was 6 p.m. here in the East Coast, you had nearly finished official results. The second thing is the Elefantenrunde, the elephant's round of the party leaders, was for most of my childhood and student years a fairly sedate affair because you only had three people in it, right? You had the Christian Democrats, the Social Democrats, and the Liberals. It was only in the late 80s that this changed, and we now have seven parties, seven party leaders in it, and that makes for a slightly more raucous atmosphere in general.
And it yes, helps they if were, someone gets drunk.
That happened with Gerhard Schröder, famously, in 2005, who had... It appeared had too much red wine and challenged Merkel's right to form a coalition.
Be wary of drunk elephants.
Yes, famous. This is also known as a case of famous last words because Merkel sort of parried him very calmly and, of course, became chancellor forever after, almost. So, of course, Schulz is right or was right last night when he said this is, among other things, Merkel's fault because Merkel fought a very presidential, very lukewarm, very unpassionate campaign at a time where there were plenty of issues to be passionate about. And I, as a German citizen, would have wanted to be her to be passionate about them. God knows. And yes, the Grand Coalition. So that includes Mr. Schulz and his party. The Grand Coalition created a sort of political entropy in the middle of the political spectrum, where important questions like the future of the refugee crisis, which, you know, because of the EU deal with Turkey, because of Italy's deals with Libya, has more or less trickled to, you know, or led to a just trickle in of refugees rather than the really large quantities arriving in 2015 and early 2016. People are still very, very worried about how this translates into their life at the local level, about integrating the more than a million people who have stayed and who need in some way or another to be made, you know, members of the workforce and at some point German citizens. That's easy with the younger ones, with the children. It's much more difficult with older men and older people in general. And so they're worried with good reasons. And the chancellor... and even my most liberal conservative friends get very angry about this. The chancellor just didn't provide public, clear answers on
this.
And
that's worked for her till now. This has sort of been her method. It's been her style. She doesn't really try to seemingly polarize or say anything in public that would upset anybody.
Extraordinary that she held that through in the in the leaders' debate last night on TV. She remained calm. She actually said at the end of the debate, "In der Ruhe liegt die Kraft." You know, in calm, my power resides in calm. as it were. I, frankly, wish her well. And I would like that to be true, but I don't think that's going to be good enough right now. I mean, one of the things that this coalition failed to do, although it literally accomplished a great deal by managing to get this sort of million and more refugees into housing, into schooling, and in many cases into jobs, what it didn't do was to reassure ordinary Germans that there would be a structure set up, an immigration and integration law that would provide for some kind of regulated process in the future. And the other thing that people are concerned about is that there are obviously some cases of people, and actually not some, just many in the hundreds of thousands of people who won't be granted the right to asylum and who will be sent back to their countries of origin. And that's proving both practically and legally incredibly difficult to do. And people are concerned that these people will be left in a sort of limbo, will become alienated, will turn to crime or to terrorism, or to, you know, exhibit other forms of social alienation.
I mean, I think this is a reasonable concern. I think it's a very useful reminder. Here in the United States, I think Merkel and her government have been treated in praised in the highest terms in terms of her liberal response to the refugee crisis. But there has been a lot of adjustments along the way that you're pointing out. Laws have been tightened. Migrants are being returned to their home countries. Various deals have been made with third countries to prevent the arrival, using coercion to prevent the arrival of people in Europe. And so that story is a lot more nuanced in terms of Merkel being the hero, the liberal open borders hero of the crisis.
Can I make two more points here, just very briefly? I actually am with those who say that letting the refugees in September 2015 was a great humanitarian gesture. Literally, Merkel didn't have a choice. If she'd closed Germany's borders, there would have been a massive humanitarian crisis in countries, European countries that were far more fragile, because these people were lined up from Austria throughout the Balkans to Turkey. And there would have been reverberations that could have completely destabilized southeastern Europe and the Balkans and the Turks. That's the first thing. I think that by letting in the refugees, she took an enormous burden off these countries, and that was an important thing to do for Europe. There are many other flaws in her handling of the crisis, and including in her then asking other European countries to take on a burden that were far less capable, far less willing to do this than we were. But the other issue here is that she's just it's perfectly true, as you say, that she, while refusing to admit that she'd done anything wrong, or refusing to concede to even her intra-party opponents that there needed to be upper limits or some kind of regulated procedure, de facto, that is exactly what has happened. And that's a classic Merkelian power technique, saying, you know, insisting on the principle, but doing something much more pragmatic in practice.
Hans, do you want to talk about what's going to happen now in terms of the parties? I mean, we have we saw the leaders at the, I'm going to say it again, Elefantenrunde. I just love that word. So do you want to tell us what's going to emerge from this, and what Merkel's options are right now?
Yeah, so I'm glad we're coming back to this, because I'm not 100% convinced that actually the Grand Coalition is over. If I had to bet, I would say there is going to be a so-called Jamaica coalition.
Which is what?
Christian Democrats and the Free Democrats, Liberal Free Democrats and the Greens. But it doesn't seem to me to be anything, I mean, it's not a foregone conclusion at all. It's going to be very difficult. This is going to be a very long process, I think, over the next couple of months. And there's no precedent, not just for a Jamaica coalition at the national level, but for a three-party coalition or a four-party coalition, if you think of the Bavarian Christian Democrats as a separate party. There's no precedent for this in the history of the Federal Republic. And so this is going to be very, very difficult. In particular, I think with these three-party coalitions, the difficulty is often not so much the big party that will be the senior partner in the coalition and its relationship with the two smaller parties, but it's the relationship of the two smaller parties to each other. So in this case, the Free Democrats and the Greens are a lot of issues that they're going to find it very difficult to reach agreement on. And you got a glimpse of this yesterday during the Elefantenrunde, when there was this brief exchange between Christian Lindner, the Free Democrat leader, and Katrin Göring-Eckardt, the Green leader, where it was quite funny how she started out by saying, "We disagree on environmental policy." He said, no, we completely agree. And then they got into a fight about it. which illustrated, I think, some of the difficulties. And they're not just, I think, about the substance of policy. In other words, the nuts and bolts of a coalition agreement. But there's also a cultural resistance, I think, particularly in the Greens, to the idea of forming a coalition with the FDP. The CSU, the Bavarian Christian Democrats, who I mentioned, are also, I think, going to be a bit of a problem. In any case, this is all a long way of saying it's not a foregone conclusion that that's going to work. And if the coalition negotiations for a Jamaica coalition fall apart, that's when I think the SPD is going to face a really difficult choice, because then it's going to be basically in a position where it's either going to agree to yet another grand coalition, which it's very reluctant to do, or it's going to be prompting new elections, which I think is going to be perceived by many German people, or at least social democrats, I think, will worry about this, that it will be perceived as being irresponsible, particularly because many people will predict that the AfD will do even better if you were to have another election. And so this is where I think it was very striking last night in the Elefantenrunde, the amount of times the word responsibility was used. I mean, again and again and again. And there's such a sense of, parties need to be responsible and act in the national interest rather than the party interest. And just a final thought on that. I think it's going to be quite puzzling to some German voters why the Social Democrats will refuse to form another grand coalition with the Christian Democrats now, given the way that they campaigned, because there was so little distance between them and the Christian Democrats. If they'd campaigned on a completely different platform where they completely disagreed with Merkel on everything, then I think it would make sense to voters why you would refuse to form another grand coalition. But in this situation, I think if I were a German voter and I didn't follow this very closely, I would find it quite puzzling why suddenly the Social Democrats are refusing to form another grand coalition, except because they worry about the consequences for themselves.
Well, particularly since they had one TV debate, Merkel refused to have a second one, despite the Social Democrats begging her for a second one, which was justifiably afterwards called a duet rather than a duel, because they were nodding at each other's remarks. No, you're quite right. The Social Democrats did not manage to wage a campaign that in any way set them off. They did try two tactics, which literally both of them backfired on them because they didn't manage to capture the national mood. And domestic policy, they tried to campaign on the basis of their criticizing supposed inequality in Germany, and the truth is that most Germans are perfectly happy in an economy that's at full employment and with record surpluses. There is rising inequality, but not that much, and that just didn't catch. And in foreign policy, they tried to suggest that Germany's 2% NATO commitment was a policy of rearmament, which didn't work because, of course, they had signed onto that commitment with a social democratic foreign minister. So that blew up in their faces. But let me be a little more optimistic, if I may, about the scenario. And there is also, by the way, one option which we haven't discussed, which is a tolerated minority government. Exactly. That's never existed in post-war Germany. And I have a hard time imagining that people would do that. I agree with you that negotiating Jamaica is going to be incredibly, painfully, excruciatingly difficult and could take us well into December. That's, in fact, how long the last coalition negotiations took with the Grand Coalition in 2013. But, if the Social Democrats went into another Grand Coalition, this, again, would leave the AfD as the opposition leader. That's not a position formally recognized, unlike in Great Britain, since we're talking for nerds here. The British Constitution recognized the opposition leader. We don't. But in practice, it would mean that they would have the right of first response, of initiating committees of inquiry, which they've already announced they want to do, and of heading the budget committee, all of which I think would be seen as deeply unhelpful by most German voters. And I would really like to get back to one important point about the AfD. Before we, treat it as a foregone conclusion that this is, as you say, a new Volkspartei, I agree with you that the AfD has pulled voters from everywhere, from more than a million non-voters, nearly a million CDU voters, half a million social democratic voters. And yes, they cross party divides, and gender divides are a lot clearer, I have to say. The AfD would never have come in third if it had been just women voting. You can see that.
Perhaps,
but it certainly crosses the edge divide.
That's the reform we need.
You know, it's always better when women get to do things, right? No, sorry, that was a joke, nerds. but the reality is this. There are some really interesting exit polls that were made yesterday where people were asked whether they had voted out of conviction or as a measure of protest. And all of the other parties, except the Alternative for Germany, all their voters said, I voted today because of conviction. And keep in mind, we had a significantly higher voter turnout this time around, with 77%. And 60% of the Alternative for Germany voters said, I voted because I wanted to protest. That is where I think the way out of this debacle lies. That means that not all of the people who voted for the AfD are convinced neo-Nazis or something like that. I mean, it's bad enough that they would vote for a party that has made the egregious statement that the leadership of the AfD has made. But if they see of this as the if two-thirds of voters think this is the only way to be heard, yeah, that means that there is a way out if the Democratic parties, which is what I prefer to call them, the Democratic parties who want to preserve Germany's constitutional order, manage to address the concerns that the German citizens have about immigration and about security, about crime and the risk of terrorism.
I want to shift a little bit now from the domestic side to the international side. Let's take Constanze's optimistic view that there will be a Jamaica coalition. What exactly will this mean for Germany's foreign policy? We are used to now treating Germany as now an important player on the global stage. That wasn't necessarily true a few years ago, but now I think everyone understands that Germany has a big role to play in Europe, has a big role to play elsewhere in the world. Let's start with Europe, though. If now, in the 4 years ahead, if Merkel's part of a Jamaica coalition, what will this mean for the European Union? And let's start, I guess, with the neighbor France and Emmanuel Macron, who was keeping an eye on this German election very closely, was waiting for this outcome in order to present his plans for the future of the European Union. Hans, do you want to describe what Macron was expecting and hoping would come out of this election and what he may be confronting instead?
Right. Well, I wrote before the election that regardless, given that it was clear that Merkel would be the chancellor, it was also clear that the Social Democrats would be the second biggest party. This was essentially a fight for third place. I wrote that regardless of what coalition were to be formed after the election under Merkel, it wouldn't make a huge difference one way or the other for Europe. I basically think that we're going to have more of the same for the next 4 years. What we've seen over the last 4-8 years in terms of Germany's response to the Euro crisis.
So you think things won't change, but people were hoping that
yes.
Germany would change.
Yes,
is that fair to say? In other words, I think people had been observing Germany and saying, okay, we just need to wait till the election. We need to wait till the election and then we'll see the shift that will really create a new lasting foundation for Europe.
Yes.
And we won't have any more of these crises after once we sort of lay the architecture.
Yes. But this was wishful thinking. And I think anyone who followed this closely, I mean, I wasn't the only person that was saying this, the idea that suddenly there would be some radical new approach to Europe after the election, regardless of who the coalition partner would have been, even if you would have had a black-green coalition, I wouldn't have expected there to be a massive change. And the Greens are probably the most
pro-European. So are you accusing Macron of wishful thinking?
Is well, no. I mean, I'm not quite sure how to read Macron's approach to Merkel at the moment, because some of the things I've seen in the last week or so suggest to me that actually what Macron is going to do is going to make very, very modest demands of Germany, essentially to ask Germany for things that Germany already wants, like, for example, this is going to get very nerdy now, but the idea of turning the European Stability Mechanism into a European Monetary Fund, which is something that Schäuble has long wanted. It seems to me that, that Macron may do something like that, in other words, make very modest demands and then claim that as a victory, even though it doesn't really help solve any of the Eurozone's problems. If he were to make more radical, more bold bolder demands of Germany, to ask Germany to do things it essentially doesn't want to do. And we'll see exactly what he says in his speech at the Sorbonne in Paris tomorrow. Then I think he's going to be disappointed because I can't see with this constellation of parties, but really, as I say, in any other constellation either, I can't really see how Merkel would be in a position to make very many concessions to France.
Let me try and, I mean, since you want us to sort of disagree with each other to make this interesting, let me try and throw an alternate version of that at you. I mean, it is, I'm sure the Jamaica negotiations, and by the way, they're called Jamaica because the party colors are black, green, and yellow, and those are the colors of the state flag of Jamaica, not because we're all reggae fans in Germany, although some of us are. But I'm sure you can imagine a couple of Bob Marley songs that could serve as mood music to
they need these.
Absolutely. Yeah. But the reality is that while we can all see the points that divide these three potential partners, the Liberals being more skeptical on Eurozone integration and on deepening of the EU, and the Greens have a really strong fundamentalist wing that frankly would rather be waterboarded than have power and sacrifice any of its principles to compromise, I think the reverse might also be true. I think because the alternative is only a tolerated minority government, another election or a grand coalition with the SPD, all of which would drive up numbers for the AfD, I think in the end they will all, I think, swallow the toad, as we say in German, die Kröte schlucken, and all of them will have to make compromises. The Liberals might have to become a little more Europe-friendly. The Greens will have to become more pragmatic. For the CDU, it won't be so difficult, actually, because they traditionally share a lot of positions with the Greens. And in fact, the Greens were always thought to be Merkel's preferred coalition partner in her last term. And remember also that this is, while we don't have term limits in the German constitution, by all historical tradition, we have never had a chancellor who attempted five terms. Adenauer, the first chancellor, did attempt, after having done four terms, he read the constitution and then told his advisors that the office of the German president had been wildly underestimated. Mm-hmm. But he was swiftly told that he was just too old for that and that this wasn't going to happen. So Merkel, for all practical purposes, is looking at her legacy term. She has an interest in staking out a few positions and making sure that this legacy is created. And I think that's going to be a pro-European and a pro-Western legacy. It will be a legacy that tries to highlight Germany's commitment to the integration of people who aren't white and who aren't of Christian faith, while at the same time asking them to toe the line on basic fundamental German constitutional values.
The one point I would just make on the five terms, Helmut Kohl ran for a fifth term, right? Did he not? Or did he lose in his fifth run, I think?
In 1998, would that have been his fifth term?
I think that would have been his fifth. I don't know. I mean, this is Google this.
Yeah,
at home.
And then he lost out because of this party scandal.
Which we don't need to get into necessarily, but I guess I just use that as a sort of the sort of seductions of power are very high. So I wouldn't be shocked if Merkel approaches.
I'm going to disagree with that. Yes, there is a big difference. Seriously, I think I really want to make this point.
She's used to the chancellery, nice cushy office.
Cameron, there is a huge difference between Merkel and Kohl. Well, Kohl and many other German politicians, I think, need power, need the limelight to feel that they are themselves. I think the fundamental difference between Merkel and many other politicians of her generation in Germany and elsewhere is that she's not needy.
So I don't know what Merkel thinks, and I think that a lot of what's said about Merkel is based on speculation or its spin coming from the people that are very close to her. I wouldn't claim to know.
I'm not close to her, and I'm not spinning you. I'm making an educated
guess. We are all objective analysts here.
I'm making an educated guess.
No one's on the payroll.
I wouldn't claim to know what Merkel's thinking and whether she's going to stand again in 4 years' time. But this also brings me to the point about Eurozone reform. because, I mean, I understand the point that Merkel will now be thinking about her legacy, but it's really not clear to me how she thinks about that. So one way of looking at that would be to say, well, she's going to make concessions to Macron because she wants to save the Eurozone. But there's another way of looking at it, which is that she precisely won't make concessions to Macron because she then thinks that her legacy will be to have destroyed the Eurozone, which is the way that a lot of people on the right in Germany look at it. I'm really not clear, you know, even if Merkel had a completely free hand, which I don't think she does, I'm not clear what she would do under these circumstances.
Let's take this hypothetical scenario. Let's say she maintains the status quo in Europe. In your perspective, then, what would her legacy be? She will have served for 16 years. If she doesn't, if she maintains the status quo, what will we look back on Angela Merkel and say about her chancellery? And that, would we call her the great humanitarian? Will we, for refugee policy, will we call her the sort of someone who is asleep at the wheel and allowed the AfD to rise? Will we say she presided over the maintenance of the European Union?
That's the million euro question, because I think that's the extraordinary thing to me right now is that it's really not clear when we look back on Merkel in 20 years' time whether she's going to go down as the woman who saved Europe or the woman who destroyed Europe. It seems to me that both of those things are possible. But by the way, I don't think that the right way to think about this is necessarily to think in terms of, you know, deepening integration of the Eurozone good, disintegration bad. This seems to me a rather binary way of thinking about it. And in particular, in these discussions about further steps that could be taken to deepen the Eurozone, actually often the fault line is not between those who want to integrate and those who don't. It's more between those who want to integrate in order to create more policy space at the EU level, which is basically the French vision of the Eurozone, and those who want to integrate, but to use these steps in integration to essentially further discipline and control member states, particularly in terms of their budgets, which tends to be the German version. So even if there's an agreement between the different coalition partners and between France and Germany on deeper integration, it's not clear to me that that's actually a very good outcome.
If what it means is
it actually just strengthens German control and surveillance and discipline over member state budgets, which is what Schäuble wants.
I mean, deepening is one thing, but stability, I think everyone would recognize as an important thing. Everyone wants stability in the Eurozone.
Let me just make a fundamental point here to reinforce what Hans is saying here. Which is that Merkel, if anything, has in the last decade re-governmentalized key aspects of European policymaking. And she gave a famous speech in Bruges where she said, this is the new union method. We are going to return important key areas of policymaking to the intergovernmental level, taking them away from the EU Commission. She has weakened the Commission. And of course, she has increased German control over this. And of course, that meant increasing control of the finance ministry and of Schäuble's Taliban policy, EU policymakers like Ludger Schuknecht. Taliban is actually his nickname in Berlin.
The chief economist.
The chief economist at the Treasury. And there is actually a somewhat nuanced sort of debate in Berlin about whether this is a good thing and whether this rigidity from the finance ministry isn't actually harmful for German national policy as well as the EU. I think Hans is right in saying that this really isn't a binary debate, and I think it may be too unbinary even for the nerds who listen to this podcast. Mm-hmm. So let's maybe not go into all the gory details of this. But I mean, the reality here is that I think Hans is right to say that it's not clear at this point whether Merkel's legacy will be a creative one or a destructive one. But I think for the time being, we can say two things. She has steered Germany successfully through an astonishing number of crises that could have killed, cut off at the knees, any number of lesser German and other European politicians. The Eurozone crisis, the refugee crisis, a really turbulent American election, etc.
I would also just point out Russia as well. Her dealings with Russia have been significant
and of course the Ukraine crisis. Yes, and she has held
Germany.
Together. She has held together despite significant resistance in her own country and among Germany's elites. Has held together the European consensus on sanctions against Russia, which is not nothing because that does also impose a cost on German business. But at the same time, it's true to say that she has, in some ways, appeared to be sleepwalking her way through the underlying greater structural changes, has refused to acknowledge those, has refused to assuage, to calm citizens' fear about these by speaking about them in public, such as the impending changes to the economy through digitalization and automation, which will take a huge hit on Germany's export-driven, manufacturing-based economy. She has refused to really talk about how to regulate an influx of immigration, which is very, very hard to stop because our borders can't be shuttered. We don't have the kind of territory. We share borders with 9 other countries. Our economic existence is dependent on integration, economic and political, with our neighbors and the rest of Europe. And under those conditions, it's actually really hard to shutter your borders against people who want to come in legally or illegally. And so you need a process of management and immigration law, which she has so far refused to do. So I think the jury is still out, but there are some significant achievements along the way.
Yeah, that is... it's worth pointing out that survival amid those crises is itself a type of legacy. Maybe that will be her monument, will be her sleepwalking of some.
Well, it was not just her personally surviving. I mean, she did bring the country through it. I think that our neighbors sometimes paid a cost for this, which I think, any responsible German, to use the word responsibility again, needs to be concerned about. I think that her ability to forge consensus within Europe on issues that affect European countries very differently, such as immigration, has been very limited. I think that that will be seen as a negative part of her legacy. And for the rest, frankly, I think we have to wait until this coalition is constituted, and including who will be Europe's foreign minister and defense minister and finance minister, Germany's foreign and defense and finance minister, to see where this will head in the next years.
Hans, do you have anything to add about what awaits Merkel in the next few years internationally?
Well, Constanza's mentioned, important issues like the refugee crisis and dealing with the Ukraine crisis and so on. But I still think that the euro crisis is the biggest, most important issue as far as the future of the EU is concerned. And here, I mean, we can argue endlessly about the rights and wrongs of Germany's approach to the euro crisis. But as somebody who's an outsider, I'm a Brit, and Britain, even before it decided to leave the EU, was not in the eurozone. So I'm kind of looking at this from the outside in a way. And I don't particularly have an axe to grind here. But one of the things that makes me most pessimistic about the future of the EU is that this is connected to the election last night as well, is that it seems to me now that there's a zero-sum game of Euroscepticism within the eurozone. In other words, what it would take in order to bring down levels of Euroscepticism in one part of Europe, so for example, the South, Italy, Greece, and so on, France as well, is precisely what would cause Euroscepticism to increase in other parts of Europe, so in the north, in countries like Germany. And conversely, what you would have to do in order to deal with the problem of the AfD in Germany is precisely what will cause Euroscepticism to increase in other parts of Europe, in the south, in relation to the Eurozone issues, or in the east of Europe, in issues around refugees. And I just don't see how you resolve that. It does seem to me not to be a zero-sum game. That makes me very pessimistic. I would love for the countries that are in the eurozone and in the Schengen area to kind of reach some kind of common understanding of what solidarity means, where they can expect solidarity, where they need to give solidarity. And as I say, I don't particularly have a particular position on this, but I find it very difficult to see what that kind of common understanding might look like.
Can I jump in here very quickly?
Please.
Because I am a German, and so for me this is personal. I've been part of German debates in what is loftily called the strategic community about fixing this and about doing, creating a more forward-leaning German foreign and security policy that attempts to resolve these conflicts and that would be more generous and more mindful, more empathetic towards the fears and concerns of the European South. For the nerds, this is the so-called Kliniker Group in 2013 wrote a paper about this that included a lot of Germany's best economists and Europe experts, and I was a member of that. these proposals are still out there. People are still fighting for that. And there is actually a debate about an internal debate in Germany, holding up the German government to its own failures and saying this isn't good enough and you will lose Europe and the European project if you don't do this.
Yeah, I would also only add, I think this is all exactly correct. I would also only add that the contradictions and tensions we've been pointing out are real, but it is a politician's job to try to communicate and to try to persuade one's own public about important strategic concerns and precisely to resolve those contradictions. So we'll see if Merkel, in her last term, or what we assume is her last term, we will see on that as well, but if she's able to do that. In the meantime, I will say thank you very much for joining us, all listeners, and we'll all be keeping an eye on Germany in the years ahead. And talk to you all later. Bye-bye. You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Cameron Abadi, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Brandon Martini and Katie Gardner. For more information about FP and to subscribe to The ER and our Global Thinkers podcast, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Thank you very much for joining us.